This is Will Friedle from Pod Meets World. Let's be honest. The 90s gave us some great things. The music, totally rad. The fashion, so fly. Home decor, that's a different story. In HGTV's new competitive series, Totally 90s House, two teams of iconic TV stars take on two homes frozen in time. Paired with HGTV experts, they'll turn dated spaces into fresh, modern homes and compete for the ultimate bragging rights. Goodbye, honey oak cabinets. Hello, 21st century. Totally 90s House. Special series premiere starts August 26th at 9, 8 central on HGTV.
This Monday.com ad was created by a team of people and AI agents. The agents wrote the copy and managed the timelines, while our human creative director made sure it all made sense. Easy. Create your own AI agent today on Monday.com.
Well, here in Spain, we're going to talk to Brett Hansen today. How are you, Brett?
I'm good, thanks. A bit hot and hoping for cooler weather, but I do live in hope.
Yes, I think we're all in the same boat at the moment. But anyway, here we go. Well, people are living longer these days, which sounds like good news. But I suppose it's both a blessing and a concern. In particular, can we and the state afford it? Let's start with the personal implications of longevity. When you're advising new retirees on their financial planning, how many years do you recommend they need to plan for?
Well, Howard, this will largely depend on how old the retirees are and what they're trying to achieve with regards to their financial planning. For example, someone retiring in, say, their late 40s may be looking at a retirement of 40 to 50 years. But at the same time, someone in their mid to late 60s may also be looking at the next 40 to 50 years because part of their aims or objectives may be to ensure that their financial plan is right, not just for them throughout their retirement, but also for their partner or spouse and their children and grandchildren. And so when we are advising new retirees on their financial planning, it's really about first establishing what are their objectives. Is it to ensure that, for example, they have sufficient income and capital for their lifetime, whilst perhaps also minimising tax? Do they wish to ensure that on their death, their partner has access to income and capital with the minimum of complications, and to ensure that they too are looked after adequately during the remainder of their years? Are they looking to minimise taxes and provide an income for their lifetimes, but also provide an income for their children or grandchildren, perhaps to ensure that, for example, there is capital to pay for their grandchildren's education? And once we establish what are the aims of the new retiree, we can then work out how long the plan should be for. But I would say, Howard, it's incredibly rare nowadays to be talking about financial plans of simply 5 or 7 years. Even if retirees are purely concerned about ensuring that there is enough income and capital for themselves, then with ever increasing life expectancies, we are generally looking at 20 to 30 years. And in fact, since COVID, there are many 50-year-olds or early 50-year-olds who have decided to stop working and retire. So for them, their years in retirement can actually be as much as 40 years, thereby potentially having more years in retirement than the number of years that they worked.
Of course, the longer we live, the longer we need our savings to last. So with inflation, must be a major concern, especially at the moment.
Yeah, I think we should always be aware of inflation. Even over the last 15 years or so, when inflation until recently was pretty benign, even a rate of a few percent can have a very damaging effect on our income and capital over the longer period of time. For example, in income terms, if you took an inflation rate of, say, 3% per year, which isn't a particularly headline-grabbing rate, and let's say that you spend around 5,000 euros a month or 60,000 euros per year, then in 10 years' time, you would need around 6,700 euros a month or just over 80,000 euros a year to be able to maintain the same spending. And if you looked a further 10 years down the line, so 20 years from when you first started taking 60,000 euros per year, you would need around 9,000 euros per month, or around 100,000 euros per year, just to maintain the same living standards. And so when in retirement, it is important that your capital and income is in a position to have the best opportunity to grow by at least the same amount as inflation, in order that you can at least stand a chance of maintaining the standards of living that you're used to. Of course, currently we are seeing inflation rates of around 9%, and whilst we're being told that these are likely to start coming down next year, though they are likely to increase even further in the shorter term, it was being predicted only 6 months ago that inflation, which at the time was running at around 5 or 6%, would be back down to around 3% now. So we're going to have to see what happens with regards to inflation. But yes, we should certainly think about this seriously when in retirement.
Many retired people favour low-risk, safer investments like bank deposits. Could being too cautious backfire?
I totally understand, Howard, why some retired people would favour keeping their capital in what is regarded as safer investments such as bank accounts. When I look at my clients, for example, who are mostly retired and are living here in Spain, they've worked hard for their money and they don't want to risk losing that capital. They will not, after all, have the opportunity or the inclination to go back to work should they lose their capital. But the problem is that cash on deposit performs so poorly against inflation, and with retirements getting ever longer, inflation is just one of the biggest risks, if not the biggest risk, to ensuring that you have enough income and capital to be able to enjoy the whole of your retirement. From time to time, I do come across retirees who have been living in Spain for a number of years and have kept their money in bank accounts because they felt that it was a safe investment. But as their spending needs have increased over time and the rates of interest has been significantly lower than the increase in the income that they've required, so they've drawn down on their capital and have found themselves in their early or mid-70s with little capital, insufficient income, and the possibility of having another 10 or 15 years struggling to meet their income and capital requirements. I mean, obviously, holding a certain amount in a bank account is necessary for short-term and emergency needs. But at the same time, I think most of us recognize that for some of our assets, exposure to investments does give us a better chance of outperforming inflation and producing what we refer to as real returns over the longer term.
So what steps can people take to invest to earn enough to comfortably beat inflation, but without taking on too much risk?
Well, first of all, the majority of our clients, Howard, as I said before, are retired, and we understand that their first priority is that it's imperative to preserve the capital that they have worked hard to accumulate through their working lifetime. We find clients are not generally looking to shoot out the lights, so to speak, when it comes to investment returns. And so the starting point, whenever someone is investing, has to be to obtain a clear and objective assessment of their appetite for risk. There are a number of ways to do this, but I find the best way to achieve this is for the client to carry out a psychometric assessment on risk, which also takes into consideration their other assets and their investment objectives. And once we've established a client's attitude to risk and objectives, we can then allocate the right amounts of the portfolio of investments to what we call traditional investments, such as cash, fixed income, which are government and corporate bonds, equities, and real assets, which include property and infrastructure funds. We stay away from new gimmicks and so-called get-rich-quick schemes. It's also important to bear in mind that when allocating money to a particular asset class, such as cash, bonds, and equities, the higher the concentration in a particular asset class, the higher the risk And so the tried and tested strategy to mitigate this risk is diversification, where you have a good spread of investments, not only in cash, bonds and equities, but also by geographical regions and market sectors, to limit a client's exposure to any single sector of the market. And as part of our diversification strategy process, Howard, we would usually also recommend a multi-manager approach so that a client's portfolio is managed by many different fund managers, each selected for their expertise in a specific market sectors. This approach then reduces our client's reliance on any one investment manager making the right decisions and provides the added diversification of differing manager styles. In fact, most of our client portfolios include more than 30 to 40 different fund managers.
Well, our pensions are obviously important for our financial security through retirement. Should people review their pensions to see if they can improve the income, but without risking their pension savings?
Yeah, for many listeners, Howard, who are retired or are thinking of retiring, their pension funds are often key to their long-term financial security, and so great care must be taken with them. Before George Osborne introduced the Pensions Freedoms legislation back in, I think it was April 2015, there were restrictions on how we could access our pension funds. In effect, back then, on retirement, you could take a cash sum of 25% of the pension fund, which was tax-free if you were a UK tax resident when withdrawing this money. And the remaining part of the pension had to be taken as a regular income, typically an annuity, or you could have opted for a drawdown if you had guaranteed pension income of at least £20,000 per year. The Pension Freedoms legislation, though, has given us more freedoms, where once we have reached 55 years of age, we can basically draw down what we'd like, when we like, from our pension funds. UK tax residents can still take a cash lump sum of 25% of the pension fund tax-free, but there is, of course, tax liabilities to consider when withdrawing the rest of the fund. And we also have to consider the prospect of exhausting our pension funds too soon if we take out too much or the fund is not growing sufficiently. And whilst these freedoms are obviously a good thing, when you're given more options as to what you can do with your pensions, then it becomes even more critical to weigh up the pros and cons of each and ensure that you make the right choice based on your circumstances, needs and tax. For many expatriates moving to Spain or are already living here but are now thinking of taking benefits from their pensions, then one of the first things they should do is establish what are the tax implications here with regards to the various options that they have open to them and what will work best for them as a Spanish resident, whilst also meeting their needs. For example, whilst I said that taking the 25% pension cash lump sum is tax-free for UK tax residents, for Spanish tax residents, it's liable to tax in Spain. It's also critical that for anyone living here in Spain, that they continue to obtain qualified, experienced advice on their pensions, bearing in mind that since Brexit, nearly all UK advisors are no longer able to advise residents in Europe on their pensions. And in times like these, when we have seen investment markets fall and inflation rise, I believe qualified, experienced advice is more critical than ever before in order to ensure that your pensions are being managed correctly in order to meet your needs.
So let's look at the implications for the state now. What impact could longevity have on the state's finances?
Well, it's a good question, Howard. I mean, at a time when governments have very large budget deficits and we have people living longer than ever before, there is no doubt that state finances throughout the developed world are going to be tested. The fact is, if we look back at the UK, for example, when the state pension was first introduced back in 1909, for those who reached 70 years of age, the life expectancy was the late 40s and early 50s. And know, we fast forward 110 years or so later, the life expectancy for a UK resident is around 83 years for a female and 79 years for a male. At the same time, the proportion of people working compared to those retired has reduced in recent years. Even if we went back to just 20 years ago, in the UK, there were approximately 4 working age individuals for every one person 65 years or over. But it's predicted that in around 30 years or so's time, it will be only 2 working age individuals to one person 65 years or over. And so with improvements in life expectancy, meaning people are living longer and reaching older ages, and people having fewer children, the current projection is that in around 45 years or so, there will be nearly an additional 9 million people in the UK aged 65 years and over. That's greater than the population of London. This means a smaller proportion of working population paying the state pensions in the UK for an ever-increasing proportion of retirees who are living longer and longer. Boris Johnson, the former Prime Minister, promised to fix social care funding crisis in the UK, which has an estimated annual cost of around, I think, £10 billion. But this annual cost, which has yet to be fixed, is only going to increase insignificantly in time. And although I've referred to the UK for much of this, I'm afraid this is a global problem. In 2015, there were around 900 million people aged 60 years and over worldwide, representing about 12% of the global population. But by 2030, this is predicted to increase to around 1.4 billion. And by 2050, it's likely to be around 2.1 billion people, or nearly 22% of the global population, that will be over 60 years of age.
Do you think this could lead to governments having to increase taxation to pay for their increasing welfare and pension costs?
Well, state pensions in both the UK and Spain are generally funded by the people working now. And so if the proportion of the population working compared to the number of people retired is decreasing, then there is undoubtedly going to be a shortfall, and the money will have to be found from somewhere. I recently read that the overall ageing population will add around $24 billion to the cost of the UK state pension and £52 billion to health spending by the tax year 2030 to 2031 compared to this year. The figures are phenomenal, and I'm afraid that Spain is not immune from this too, and the likely solution is indeed going to be tax rises in the future.
So what's your advice to retired expatriates on how to protect themselves from higher taxes?
Well, with appropriate financial planning, Howard, I do believe that most listeners should be able to structure their assets, investments and pensions in order to minimise the various taxes in Spain, which include income tax, capital gains tax, wealth tax and Spanish succession tax. There are also a number of solutions that are available to minimise these taxes in Spain, whilst also being able to invest in a manner which meets your attitude to risk in order to minimise the impact of inflation on both income and capital. And so, as always, if any of our listeners would be interested in exploring this, then they can contact their local Blevins Franks office, where they can talk to an experienced, qualified advisor who will be able to look at their circumstances, their objectives, their financial planning needs, and advise them of the possible solution to these. Our website is www.blevinsfranks.com, and if you go onto that, in addition to finding your local office, there's also additional information, podcasts, videos, and tax guides that can be found of interest there.
Well, thank you very much, Brett. That was very interesting. We'll chat again in a fortnight.
Thanks, Howard. It's good to talk to you and speak to you in 2 weeks' time. Yes.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids, some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.